It was 7 in the morning when Fogg, Auder and Passepartout set foot on the North American continent at San Francisco. Fogg inquired when the first train left for New York. It departed at 6 p.m. He hailed a carriage for Mrs. Auder and himself. Passepartout climbed on top, and at $3 a ride, the vehicle headed for the International Hotel, where they had breakfast. Afterwards, Passepartout asked his master's permission to buy several Colt revolvers. Why? He had heard tell that Sioux and Pawnee Indians were partial to stopping trains and scalping passengers. Mr. Fogg left him free to act as he wished. Leaving Passepartout at the hotel, he and Mrs. Auder went to the British consulate to have Fogg's passport stamped. On emerging, they bumped into Fix. The inspector asked for permission to join them in looking round San Francisco, and permission was granted. They soon found themselves in the midst of huge crowds on Montgomery Street. Banners and streamers waved in the wind. Shouts rang out from all directions. "Hooray for Camerfield! Hooray for Mandy Boy!" Fix was just about to ask someone to explain this popular effervescence when a more pronounced movement became apparent. The hoorays got louder, and curses were added. The poles of the banners became offensive weapons. All sorts of objects were thrown, and it even seemed as if a few revolvers were adding their explosive voices to the crowd's bellowing. "It might be a good idea to withdraw," said Fix. "If all this has anything to do with Britain and we are recognised, we might be at risk." "A British subject..." But Fogg wasn't allowed to finish. From behind him came frightening roars of, "Hip, hip, hooray, Mandy Boy!" It was a company of supporters riding to the rescue, outflanking the Camerfield men. Fogg, Auder and Fix were caught between the two lines of fire. Armed with studded sticks and clubs, this torrent of men proved irresistible. Fogg and Fix protected the young woman and were horribly shoved and pushed. Nevertheless, they defended themselves with the weapons which nature has put at the end of the arms of every Briton. A great strapping man, with broad shoulders, a red goatee and a ruddy complexion, apparently the leader of the mob, raised his formidable fist against Mr. Fogg, who would have suffered considerable damage if Fix had not taken the blow in his place. A huge bump immediately developed under the detective's silk hat, now converted into a flat cap. "Yankee," said Mr. Fogg, giving his adversary a look of deep contempt.
"Limey,
we should meet to settle this question."
"Whenever you want. Your name?"
"Phileas Fogg. And yours?"
"Colonel Stamp W. Proctor."
After this exchange, the ebb and flow parted the antagonists. "Thank you," said Fogg to Fix, as soon as they had escorted Mrs. Auder out of the crowd.
"Don't mention it," said Fix, and took his leave, promising to see them at the station.
Fogg and Mrs. Auder returned to the hotel, where Passepartout, now armed with half a dozen six-shot central percussion revolvers, was waiting for them. At 5:45, they arrived at the station and found their train ready to leave. Just before getting on, Mr. Fogg went up to a porter. "My friend, was there not a little trouble today in San Francisco?"
"A meeting, sir."
"I thought I noticed a certain animation."
"Just an election meeting."
"Electing a field marshal?"
"No, sir. A justice of the peace."
The train left at 6 p.m. on December the 3rd, as snow began to fall. By the morning of December the 7th, the continent was concealed beneath a thick, white blanket. The train had covered the best part of 1,000 miles and was standing in Green River Station in Wyoming. Some of the passengers were strolling along the platform. Through the window, Mrs. Auder recognized Colonel Stamp W. Proctor, the American who had behaved so rudely to Mr. Fogg in San Francisco. She had grown attached to the man who gave her evidence every day of the most absolute devotion. So her heart stopped when she recognized the coarse brute from whom Mr. Fogg had made it clear that he wished to seek satisfaction. Obviously, it was absolutely vital to prevent Phileas Fogg from seeing his adversary. Once the train had started off again, Mrs. Oudah took advantage of a moment when Mr. Fogg was dozing to bring Fix and Passepartout up to date.
"That man, Proctor, on our train?" exclaimed Fix. "Well, rest assured, madam, that before dealing with Mr. Fogg, he will have to deal with me."
"Mr. Fix," said Mrs. Oudah, "Mr. Fogg will let nobody take on the task of avenging his honour. If he notices Colonel Proctor, we shan't be able to prevent an encounter. He simply mustn't be allowed to see him." Was there a way of keeping Mr. Fogg in the carriage? The inspector thought he had found one. A few moments later, when Mr. Fogg had emerged from his nap, he said to him,
"These are long and torturous hours, sir, that we are spending on the train."
"Indeed."
"I believe you used to play some whist on the steamships."
"Yes, indeed. But here it would be difficult. I have neither cards nor partners."
"We'll easily be able to get some cards. They sell everything on American trains. And as for partners, if by any chance, madam..."
"Certainly, sir," Mrs. Oudah eagerly answered. "I can play whist. It's part of a British education."
"And I too," said Fix. "Played the game fairly well. Now, with three of us and a dummy..."
"Perfect," replied Fogg.
"Now we've got him," murmured Passepartout to himself. "He won't budge."
After a comfortable lunch, served at the seats themselves, Mr. Fogg and his partners had just resumed their card game when loud whistle blasts were heard, and the train stopped. Passepartout rushed out of the carriage. About 40 people had already left their seats, including Colonel Stamp W. Proctor. The train had pulled up at a stop signal. The engine driver and guard were having a lively discussion with a track watchman, sent to meet the train by the station master at Medicine Bow, the next stop. Passepartout heard the watchman say,
"There's no way you can get across Medicine Bow Bridge. It's already shaky and won't take the weight of the train."
"Good Lord," exclaimed Colonel Proctor. "We're not going to stay here, I hope."
"Colonel," said the guard, "we telegraphed Omaha Station to get a replacement train, but it probably won't arrive in Medicine Bow for 6 hours.
6 hours?
Exclaimed Passepartout.
"And anyhow," continued the guard, "it'll take us all that time to reach the station on foot."
"On foot?"
cried the passengers in unison. Then the engine driver roared,
"Gentlemen, there may be a way to get across."
"Over the bridge?"
"Over the bridge."
"Without train?"
"Without train."
"But the bridge is falling down,"
said the guard.
"My idea is that by sending the train hurtling along at full speed, we might have some chance of crossing."
"Evans," said Passepartout.
The suggestion pleased Colonel Proctor. He pointed out that certain engineers had had the notion of crossing rivers without a bridge at all by using rigid trains going at full speed. In the end, all those discussing the question were on the driver's side.
50% chance," said one.
60,
said another. 80, 90%.
Passepartout was horrified. The idea seemed to him a little too American.
"Sir," he said to one of the passengers, "the method proposed seems a little risky to me."
80% chance," was the reply.
"But a moment's thought."
"No thinking, there's no point," retorted the American. "The driver says we can get across."
"But mightn't it be safer?"
"What do you mean, safer?"
roared Colonel Proctor, having overheard the exchange.
"At full speed, I tell you. Don't you understand? Full speed."
"But it would still be safer,"
Passepartout persisted.
"Or, since that word shocks you, at least more natural."
"Who? What?
How?
What's the matter with him?"
The exclamations came from all directions.
"You're afraid, aren't you?"
said Colonel Proctor.
"Me? Afraid?" exclaimed Passepartout.
To himself he added,
"I'll show these people that a Frenchman can be just as American as they are. But no one can stop me thinking that it would have been more natural for us passengers to have crossed the bridge on foot first, and then the train afterwards."
Back on the train, he sat down without saying anything. The players were still absorbed in their game. The locomotive whistled. The driver, putting the train in reverse, took it back for about a mile, retreating like an athlete who wishes to build up speed. Then, on a second whistle blast, it moved forward, accelerated, and soon achieved a terrifying speed. All that could be heard was a continuous whinnying from the locomotive. The pistons pumped, the axles smoked. It could be felt that the train, moving at 100 miles an hour, no longer weighed on the rails, so to speak. Gravity was absorbed by speed. And they made it. Nothing could be seen of the bridge. Like greased lightning, the train leapt from one bank to the other, and the driver only managed to stop it 5 miles beyond the next station. But hardly had the train crossed before the bridge crashed down into Medicine Bow Rapids. That same evening, the train arrived at Evans Pass, where the railroad reached its highest point, 8,091 feet above sea level. It was now downhill all the way to the Atlantic. 4 more nights and days would be enough to reach New York. Phileas Fogg was still within the statutory time. By 9 o'clock the next morning, Mr. Fogg and his partners had started their game again. Fix had begun by winning a few guineas, which he was now losing again. That morning, luck singularly favoured Mr. Fogg. Trumps and honours rained down from his hands. At one point, having thought out a bold plan, he was just about to play a spade when a voice was heard behind his seat.
"Personally, I would play a diamond."
Mr. Fogg, Mrs. Owder, and Fix looked up. Colonel Proctor was standing beside them. Stamp W. Proctor and Phileas Fogg recognized each other instantly.
"Ah, so it's you, the Limey. You were going to play a spade."
"And I am playing it," Phileas Fogg replied coldly, putting down a 10.
"You know nothing about this game," said the Colonel.
"Perhaps I'll prove more skillful at another," said Fogg, standing up.
"It's up to you if you want to try, son of John Bull."
Mrs. Owder had gone quite pale. She seized Phileas Fogg's arm, but he pushed her away gently. Fix had also risen and said,
"You forget that I am the one you must deal with, sir. You have not only insulted, but struck me."
"Mr. Fix," said Fogg, "forgive me, but this is my affair. When he claimed that I was wrong to play a spade, the Colonel insulted me again, and he will have to give me satisfaction."
"When you like, where you like," replied the American, "using whatever weapons you like."
"I leave it to you to suggest where we should meet," said Fogg.
"Do you know Plum Creek?"
"No."
"The next stop. The train will be there in an hour. It'll stop for 10 minutes. Quite a few revolver shots can be exchanged in 10 minutes.
"As you wish. I'll alight at Plum Creek," agreed Phileas Fogg.
"And I believe you'll stay there,"
said the American, with unbelievable insolence. "Who knows, sir?" And Mr. Fogg returned to his game. At 11 that morning, the train approached Plum Creek Station. Mr. Fogg got up and, with Fix following, moved out onto the open platform at the end of the carriage. Passepartout went with them, carrying a pair of the revolvers he had bought in San Francisco. The door of the other carriage opened, and Colonel Proctor appeared, followed by his second, a Yankee of the same mold. But just as the two foes were going to step down, the guard arrived.
"No going down, sirs." "Why not?"
asked the Colonel.
"We're 20 minutes late, and the train's not waiting." "But I have to fight this gentleman." "I'm sorry, sir, but we're leaving immediately."
There's the bell.
The bell was indeed ringing, and the train moved off again.
My apologies, gentlemen, said the guard. But what's stopping you fighting on board the train?
Perhaps sir might not like that,
sneered Colonel Proctor. I like it perfectly, replied Phileas Fogg. Preceded by the guard, the two duelists headed for the rear of the train. The last carriage was occupied by about a dozen travellers. The guard asked if they would be so kind as to vacate the carriage for a few minutes for two persons who had a matter of honour to settle. They were only too happy to oblige the two gentlemen. The carriage was perfect. The adversaries could advance between the rows of seats and blunderbuss each other to their heart's content. Mr. Fogg and Colonel Proctor, each equipped with 2 6-shooters, entered the carriage. Their seconds, remaining outside, shut them in. On the first whistle blast from the locomotive, they were to open fire. After exactly 2 minutes, whatever remained of the gentlemen would be removed. Fix and Passepartout were waiting for the whistle, when suddenly shots rang out, but not from the duelists. On the contrary, they came from the whole length of the train. Cries of terror were heard from the middle carriages. Colonel Proctor and Mr. Fogg, revolvers in hand, immediately came out of the carriage and rushed to the front. They had realized that the train was being attacked by a band of Sioux Indians. About 100 had leapt from their galloping horses onto the footboards and climbed up the outside of the carriages. They had started by rushing the engine. The driver and the fireman had been half-killed by blows from a club. A Sioux, trying to stop the train but not knowing how to operate the brake, had opened the steam up instead, and the train was travelling on at a frightening speed. At the same time, the Sioux had invaded the carriages, knocking in the doors and fighting hand-to-hand with the passengers. Something had to be done. Fort Kearney Station was only 2 miles ahead. This was an American military outpost. But once past it, the Sioux would be masters of the train until the next station. The guard was fighting at Mr. Fogg's side when a bullet knocked him flat. As he fell, he shouted,
"We're lost if the train doesn't stop in the next 5 minutes."
"It will stop," said Phileas Fogg, rushing out of the carriage.
"Wait, sir," shouted Passepartout. "This one's for me."
Phileas Fogg didn't have time to stop the brave fellow opening a door and sliding underneath the speeding carriage. And while the battle raged, he worked his way under the carriages with wonderful skill and thus reached the head of the train. And then, using one hand to hang on between the luggage van and the tender, he unhooked the safety chains with the other. Because of the traction, he would never have been able to disconnect the coupling pin if a jolt of the locomotive hadn't jerked it free. The locomotive sped on at increasing speed as the carriages gradually fell behind and finally stopped less than 100 yards from Kearney Station. The soldiers from the fort ran up quickly, but the Sioux didn't wait for them. Before the train had finally stopped, the whole band had cleared off towards the south. But when the travellers did a roll call, they realized that 3 were missing. Amongst them, the brave Frenchman, whose devotion had saved their lives. Had they been killed in the struggle? Were they prisoners of the Sioux? It was too soon to say. There were quite a number of wounded, but it was quickly realized that none were fatally injured. One of the most seriously hurt was Colonel Proctor, who had been knocked down by a bullet to the groin. Mrs. Ouder was safe. Phileas Fogg was totally unharmed. Fix had been hit in the arm, but the wound was not serious. The captain commanding Fort Kearney was present. His soldiers, about 100 in all, had taken up defensive positions. "Sir," Mr. Fogg said to the captain, "3 passengers have disappeared. Dead? Dead or prisoners. Do you intend to pursue the Sioux?"
"I can't abandon the fort under my command.
The lives of 3 men are at stake. But can I risk the lives of 50 to save 3? "I don't know if you can, sir, but you must."
"Sir,"
answered the captain, "no one here should tell me what my duty is." "As you wish," said Phileas Fogg coldly. "I'll go alone, then."
"You will not go alone," exclaimed the captain, moved in spite of himself. "You are a brave man. 30 volunteers,
he cried, and his company stepped forward as one man. 30 soldiers were designated, and an old sergeant placed himself at their head. "Thank you, Captain," said Mr. Fogg. As the gallant band set off, Mrs. Oudah retired to a room in the station, and there she waited alone, thinking of Phileas Fogg, his great and simple generosity, his quiet courage. At about 2 p.m., as snow was falling in large flakes, long whistles were heard coming from the east. An enormous shadow, preceded by a tawny light, was advancing slowly on the station. What was this fantastic manifestation? The mystery was soon solved. The locomotive had shot along the track for several miles. Then the fuel had run out and the fire had died down. It had stopped 20 miles beyond Kearney Station. Both fireman and driver were still alive. After being unconscious for quite a while, they had come to again. The driver didn't hesitate. Shovelfuls of coal and wood were thrown into the firebox, the flames roared, the pressure rose, and the locomotive started back down the line in reverse. This was the manifestation which arrived at Kearney Station at about 2 o'clock and took up its position at the head of the train. Mrs. Oudah came out of the station building and spoke to the assistant guard as the rest of the passengers returned to their carriages. "Are you leaving?"
"Very soon, madam."
"But the prisoners, our unfortunate companions."
"I can't hold up the service. We're 3 hours late as it is. If you want to come with us, please get in."
The driver blew the whistle. The train started off. It had soon disappeared, mingling its white steam and smoke with the whirling masses of the snowflakes. Mrs. Oudah had not moved. Neither had Inspector Fix. Hours went by. Evening closed in. Then night fell. All night Mrs. Oudah wandered on the edge of the prairie, her mind full of sinister foreboding. Inspector Fix remained motionless, seated on a bench in the station. At one point a man came up and said something to him, but the detective dismissed him with a shake of the head. It was 7 in the morning when shots rang out. The soldiers rushed out of the fort and saw a little troop about 1/2 mile away. Mr. Fogg was marching at its head, and with him Passepartout and the other 2 passengers snatched from the hands of the Sioux. There had been a fight 10 miles south of Kearney. Passepartout and his 2 companions were already struggling with their captors. The Frenchman had knocked 3 of them out with his fists when his master and the soldiers had come rushing to their aid. Both the saviors and the saved were welcomed at Kearney with great shouts of joy. The train had gone, and Phileas Fogg was 20 hours behind schedule. Passepartout, the involuntary cause of the delay, was in a state of despair. He had ruined his master. At this moment, the inspector came up to Mr. Fogg. He said, "There may yet be a way to get to New York before the Liverpool steamship leaves."
"How?"
"By sledge, or rather land yacht. Someone has suggested this means of transport to me." This was the man who had spoken to the inspector during the night. Fix pointed out the man, and Phileas Fogg went up to him. A moment later, he and this American, who was called Mudge, went into a nearby cabin. Mr. Fogg examined a remarkable vehicle, a sort of sledge, with room for 5 or 6 people, with a mast rigged like a sloop. These vehicles carry a prodigious amount of sail, even more than a racing cutter. With the wind behind, they glide over the snow-covered surface of the prairies at a speed equal to express trains. In a few moments, a bargain had been struck. The wind was favourable, blowing quite strongly from the west, and Mudge was confident he could get Mr. Fogg to Omaha Station within a few hours. Trains are frequent there, with many lines leading to Chicago and New York. At 8 a.m. the sledge was ready to leave. The travellers got on and carefully wrapped themselves up in travelling rugs. The 2 huge sails were hoisted, and the vehicle moved off over the hardened snow, reaching a speed of 40 knots. The distance between Fort Kearney and Omaha is 200 miles at most. If there were no incidents, the sledge would be there by 1 o'clock. What a trip! The sledge glided over the plain as lightly as a vessel on the surface of the waters, but without the swell. When the wind blew stronger, it seemed as if the sledge was lifted from the ground by its sails. The jib had been perked and was no longer shielded by the spanker. A topmast was sent up, and a topsail added its driving force. The wind blew hard enough to bend the mast, held solidly in place by iron rigging, its metal ropes vibrating like stringed instruments. The sledge flew on in the midst of a plaintive harmony of remarkable intensity. "These strings are producing the fifth and the octave," Mr. Fogg declared, after a moment's reflection. The landscape was absolutely deserted. From time to time, a frowning tree would pass in a flash, a white skeleton twisting in the wind. Sometimes packs of prairie wolves, lean and hungry, forced on by a fierce desire, would race the sledge. If some accident had occurred, the travellers would have been in terrible danger. But the sledge held good. At midday, Mudge pointed towards a cluster of snow-covered roofs.
"We're there!"
There indeed. At that station, which, with its frequent trains, is in daily contact with the east of the United States. A through train was leaving. Phileas Fogg and his companions just had time to throw themselves into a carriage. At 4 p.m. the following day, the 10th, it arrived in Chicago, and the party changed lines. The frisky locomotive of the Pittsburgh-Fort Wayne-Chicago Railroad set off at full steam, as if it realized there was no time to waste. Like a flash, it crossed Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Finally, the Hudson River appeared, and at 11:15 p.m. on the 11th of December, the train pulled up in the station on the right bank of the river, in front of the pier for the Cunard Line steamers. The China, bound for Liverpool, had left 45 minutes earlier.